Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. Today, ratio analysis. As is our usual, though, we will take a brief look at the numbers and see if that dead cat is still bouncing around. Here, Kitty. Well, hello, Kitty. What do you say to this? In your judgment, ma'am, is this a bull day or a bear day? Huh? Bull. Yeah, I was going to say woman. No. No. This is definitely a bull day. It's actually a strong bull day. I mean, notice in that the typical pattern, the Dow 30, the big ones that don't move a whole lot, up 0.6%. Then the S&P 500, a lot more companies, bigger, faster, more competitive, up 1.15%. And there's the Nasdaq up 1.5%. So you see that pattern over and over again. And patterns are gold when you're dealing with in the stock market, because they normally don't exist, but this one's just one that has to do with the risk-return relationship that is so fundamental to finance. But, actually, I took some weird positions. This is a market that is kind of unpredictable, and it also, to some extent, defies the idea that we are in a bear market. On the other hand, you could have something else going on here. There's an old strategy, or it's a tactic. It's actually illegal these days, but that doesn't mean it's not done. I mean, hell, this is finance. Illegal? What's legal? Oh, that's what the little guy gets caught doing. It's called running out the shorts. Now, running out the shorts is where you deliberately make it look like there's a bad situation, so all of these bears, amateurs, dive in, and then you just quickly turn it around on them and start buying hard with big volume, and it just tears them apart. You take their money, you take their dinner money, and you move on with your life. It's called running out the shorts. Now, interestingly enough, that was actually a dramatic version of that happened with GameStop, with Wall Street Bets last year, because that should never have happened. And it was hilarious because these professionals that set up short positions just make money off it. It's just like an engine for them. They set up their short positions all the time. They had no idea that this mass of horde of unwashed heathen were going to attack and buy it, and it just wiped out the capital of a couple of these big Wall Street firms that did this just to make money every day, putting short positions. Because when the GameStop buyers from Wall Street Bets bought in, it shot the price insanely high, and there these professional short sellers were looking around like, what just happened? Of course, they were crying crocodile tears, demanding that there were regulations be put into place to stop these awful, evil people, whatever. Okay, but anyway, yeah, we have this crude oil. It had a surge, and then it's dropped back. It's really having a hard time climbing around right now. Now, the gold and silver, the metals, are shedding money, which means that money is probably flowing into equities. That's why we have this. And the bonds, interestingly enough, down 2.3 basis points, which means their price is going up. So there's money flowing to bonds and to stocks. So debt and equity are both getting the benefit of investors, although this is not much of a pop right here. Their bonds are being bought too. And then going over here, you can see that London had some hammer of bad news through to midday, and then that ended, and it just sort of waited for something else to happen, and nothing did, so it just kind of floated for the rest of the day. Over here, there was bad news at the beginning of Tokyo's trading day, and then something pushed the market up, and then again, no more news, so there's no more price net price movement. So we're all going to just sit here now looking, wondering what's going to happen on Monday. A little hint. Look at the volume on the S&P 500. Now, it was very sharp, hard volume in the first part of the day. And now it's kind of slowed down so that we're going to end the day with not getting toward the 52-week average daily volume. So that means that there was actually some surge of institutional investment buying in the morning, and then they just sort of stopped. And although if you look at the pattern, there was price pressure again here. It's going to be a hard call what's going to happen on Monday morning. My sentiment is that we're going to have another day up, a bull day. And what happens from there, heaven only knows. But it's obviously, no one can predict accurately, perfectly, what's going to happen in the future. That's the whole point. This is a random walk. But at the same time, it looks like the sentiment is right now fairly positive. The traders that I talked to through the day were in a good mood. There wasn't talk about the war. There wasn't talk about the inflation. There wasn't talk about the Federal Reserve. That's all back there. So now they're just feeling a little bit chipper for almost no reason, I guess. Anyway, that's where we sit today. Now, in your resources tab is this financial analysis formula sheet. These are the financial ratios. You can have this with you when you take a quiz or a test. And on this, you can even scribble some words about what each of these means and all of this. There's no problem with that. Don't turn this into a note card. You get one of those for your midterm and your final. This is just something to keep you from making a mistake in not memorizing the right formula. Honestly, as I said before, the numbers, calculating them, I'm not impressed with you if you can calculate these. You should be able to. On the other hand, what I really want to know is, do you understand how to interpret these numbers? If you love numbers, major in accounting. Make sure this is your last course where you actually have to use your mind and think about what the numbers mean. But if that's okay with you, then you're going to be fine in this class, because calculating the numbers isn't what impresses me at all. In fact, once I've done this, I'll show you on Monday where you can get all of these ratios. With a click of a button, you can see 5 years of financial ratios for any company you want. You can then go back and say, well, show me the comparable ratios for companies that are like this company. You can get that just with a click of a button in Standard & Poor's Global Net Advantage, to which you have access as students of the university. So it's telling me what they mean that matters. Now, going over here, we're going to get, and I did some of this already with you, and now we're going to take it seriously. I'm going to get the financial statements of Target. And I strongly encourage you to have your computer out on this occasion so that you can follow along, because I will anticipate that you can do this in a quiz or an exam. You can take financials and get things out of them. Interactive data. By the way, what I do here today, I will upload what I've built to your ReggieNet. It'll be tonight before I get a chance to upload it. But so you don't have to furiously type fast, and you just have to follow along to the extent that you can. and get the target financials up. Really? SEC.gov. Let's pull it up. I'm going to talk a little bit here. A couple of things. One problem we have rather commonly, it's actually a problem. People put on the resume, I know Excel. That's one of their skills, and they don't. Not the way it is in professional use, which is what will be expected of you. If you say, I know Excel, they're going to expect you to know Excel. Now, another thing. What I'm going to show you here, as much as doing the ratios, I'm going to show you some best practices, how you do things in Excel in the most professional and secure way possible. We're going to start out with something about managing worksheets. This is yours to change as you want. One thing is that ratio analysis uses the income statement and the balance sheet. Now, later we'll also use the statement of cash flows. So the first thing that I would want to do is I would want to get the consolidated balance sheet, this thing right here, I would want to slide that over so that it was right next to my income statement so that I can shuttle back and forth without scrolling and all that. Okay? You want to make sure that you're in control of this. Now, the next part of this is something that is almost not known until you really need to know it. I was showing in a faculty meeting, some things about Excel, and I quickly went through Secure, Contain, Protect. And I told them, this is what I'm doing, and they looked at me like, what's that about? That sounds stupid. Okay, Secure, Contain, Protect actually comes from the gaming world from a long time ago. Securing the entities, containing them so that they do what you want, and protecting them from danger. And in Excel, this has great meaning. You secure the information, the raw information, and then you contain your calculation where they won't be bothered. And then you protect them so that no one goes in and changes things that they don't need to change. Give you an example of this. This was 4 or 5 years ago. An executive officer in the finance division of a very large corporation described what had happened. They hired some new person. He came with good recommendations, strong claims about his knowledge of Excel. Well, they gave him some Excel sheets, and he went in and he pulled up some bigger sheets, deeper sheets. And then he said, he thought, I can do things here better than this. So he started removing formulas, putting in what he thought was best, and changing all kinds of things around, turning what had been a building Excel spreadsheet over a period of 10 years into a catastrophe. Then he saved it. And then no one knew what he had done until that saved version had overwritten the backup version at the cloud server. They fired his ass right on the spot. But the problem was that they were not following the best practices. You see, end users do not need to see the working parts. They need to see the final product. Intermediate users, generally, you don't want them seeing the calculations, the formulas. They don't need to know that. They just need to know how to input data. So ideally, what would happen, and I may have the time later to show you this. It's called a dashboard. It's a front worksheet that the end users can look at, see the numbers, talk about them. But everything behind them is contained. And it's also locked. So you secure, contain, and protect so that those end users aren't prowling around. Well, how did you get this? Well, I'm looking at the formula. I don't understand this. What is a sum function? You don't want them to do that. You're in control of the Excel sheet. So in other words, I'm going to create a sheet here. And this is not the dashboard. This is the contain. This is the containment of the calculations. I'm going to insert a worksheet. And I'm going to call it ratios. This is where I'll do the actual calculations. And then if I were in a corporate environment, I would lock this sheet down so that people couldn't go in there and play with it. You obviously need some people who are going to look through your work, audit, and make sure that you didn't screw up. But the end users do not need to see how you got that dashboard, these ratios are, how you got your analysis, well, having them question your formulas and ask idiotic things. The ratio sheet is for us to do our calculations and then to report them out to a dashboard. So this is the one where we actually do the calculations. Now, another thing, and this I'll take you back to my time when I was the dean of education of a school for court reporters and transcriptionists. One thing when you are creating Excel or typing up notes or whatever, if you are looking for the most efficient way to do it, you do not format along the way, ever. You get everything in there raw, and then you go back and make it pretty. I can't emphasize that enough. In fact, in transcription, one of the reasons that I don't want you to use your computers in the classroom, in a normal classroom, is because we get a transcriptionist stare. A good transcriptionist is no longer in the room. It's just coming through and going onto the paper. Most of them cannot even remember. I saw it myself. They don't even remember what they transcribed. However, in that kind of an environment, when you make a typing mistake, you do not correct it. Don't ever correct. You do that at the end. Just keep going. Fight the urge to keep going back and fixing things. Unless it's critical. You just keep plowing if you make a typo. Later, you can format, you can fix your little errors, whatever. But every time you stop to go fix something, you have made yourself lose time and lost the flow of what's coming at you. Now, in this regard, if you were to look at what I've done here, quit it. I gave you these financial ratios. Now, you notice that there are different categories of them: profitability, liquidity, debt, and asset activity. Now, one thing here is, I'll tell you right off the bat, I'll deal with market value a little later in the course. They do MV and EV in the textbook. I'm not going to test you on those yet. I'll mention MV. It's actually very market to book is actually a very important concept, and I'll mention that probably on Monday. I'm not going to push on DuPont right now. Up here on asset activity, this first one, average collection period, that one is a bear to work because these financial statements here, see them? All of these, the core statements will not show average daily collection. They just won't. You'll have to go way in here and prowl around to find your collection, how much of your day's sales were not cash, they were receivables. It's not easy to find, and I don't pay too much attention to it. Now, I think in your textbook, they've got a homework problem with average collection period, but they give you the average daily credit sales. to find it on your own. I mean, I used to try to do that, and I would be prowling around, where the heck is that thing? So I don't do that one in this class very much. And some of these others, I will give you some context. But the important part is, what do these numbers mean? Now, I will do the raw stuff today, and then on Monday, we'll go through and we'll start asking the important questions. Is this a good number? Is this a bad number? Is there a trend? Is it a good trend? Is it a bad trend? Other indicators. Sometimes what everyone thinks is a great number is actually a sign of a disaster waiting to happen. See this inventory turnover ratio? Sales divided by inventory. What that actually means is how many times in a year all of the inventory was cleared out of the warehouses and sold. So the higher the better, right? I mean, because that's less storage space, warehouse space, and all of that. You're really cranking at 7, 8, 10, 12. Wonderful. Until it's not. Give you an idea. The Japanese have a system called just-in-time. They have zero inventory, so inventory turnover ratio is infinite. Why? Because they have this ring of suppliers right around the core automobile manufacturing facility. When they need a door, they just say, bring a door over. And it's made and brought over. You need headlights? Well, make some headlights and bring them over. So their system is absolutely staggering. It's extraordinary. Our auto manufacturers tried to replicate it, and it created a nightmare. In fact, it destroyed a couple of cities because it wasn't made for the American framework of business and capitalism. Another thing is, you're seeing the problem with accelerating inventory turnover right now in our lives. If you are cranking out, we get that in the warehouse and we sell it right away. We get more in, sell it right away. Get it in, sell it right away. Well, what happens if you suddenly have a bottleneck in your supply chain? Just a billowing nightmare of back orders happens. Empty shelves, pissed off customers. And so, surprisingly, you go to small stores that don't fight with inventory, that accelerating inventory. They keep stuff in the warehouse, and surprise, they've got stuff on their shelves that the big box retailers don't, because the bottlenecks that happen, you could smooth them out because you've got some in inventory. Okay, you're 2 weeks instead of 1 week. Well, we got some in inventory. So going hyper on accelerated inventory turnover is not always a good idea. Okay, now let me go, and we're just going to go through, and you're going to see how to do this. Some of you already know how to do this, but the first thing we're going to do is, this is the ratio sheet. So the first thing we're going to do is lay out the ratios. First, the profitability ratios. There's the gross margin, the net margin, and the operating margin. And then the net margin. Then the return on assets and the return on equity. And again, don't sweat it if you can't get them all. I will upload what I'm doing here for you. Like I said, I'll get it done tonight after dinner. Sad dinner that it is. Wait a minute, I've got leftover meatloaf. I'm good. Okay. So now the next one are the liquidity ratios. And there's the current assets, current ratio. There's the quick ratio, and you'll hear me call this one the acid test, or acid. That's the common name for it, acid. The formal name is quick ratio. And then there's one that the book doesn't show you. It's old school, and it has disappeared from textbooks. But interestingly enough, the burn ratio. Last year, I was reading some analyst reports on GameStop. This was before the Wall Street Bets thing. And there was this younger woman who was an analyst, and she was looking at GameStop. It looked terrible. I mean, it was just a disaster. But she said cash over current liabilities for GameStop is phenomenal. She didn't call it the burn ratio, but that's the burn ratio. And I thought, where would she have seen this? And I was looking at her name to see if she'd been my student. Apparently, she was taught somewhere this old school burn ratio, which is essentially, at the end of the day, if you have to pay off all of your current liabilities immediately, the only thing you've really got isn't your current assets or your current assets minus your inventory. It's just your cash. And GameStop had this staggering current ratio of like six times over they could pay their current liabilities with the cash they had. You don't even see that. That's insane. And so that told anyone who was paying attention, GameStop is not on its deathbed. It is definitely not on its deathbed, which every other analyst said. Okay, now, anyway, going on here, what was I thinking? Oh, debt. Now, there are two here. Debt to total assets. And then there's the times interest earned. And then there's the asset activity ratios. The first one, we're not going to do that days payable thing. We're going to go for the meat. We're going to do inventory turnover and asset turnover. Notice something that I'm doing here. I'm not going and typing one out and doing all the calculations. Go to another one, type it out, do the calculations. You focus on one thing at a time. I get the numbers, I get the labels in. That way you're not going back and forth trying to think of formulas and typing of something of words, formulas, typing something in words. Get all of it done. Now, the next thing, we can do a little bit of formatting here. And I'm going to take the names. I'm coughing here. And I'll make those bold. And then I'll take the calculations within. And I'll scoot them over a little bit. Oops, sorry. No, I'm, geez, oh, there we go. Should have done that. See, I get the formatting done after I've gotten in the information. If I got any typos, I can fix those before I get down to business. This is just setting it up, getting all of your tools in place so that you can then go in and use those tools, one after the other. This is efficiency. And this is, believe it or not, you get this down and you will do spreadsheets a lot faster than if you are trying to do different things one after the other. Focus on one thing. Now we can do calculations. Now we're going to do the gross margin. That is going to be the... Oh, I screwed up something. I didn't see it. Ouch. Many companies do not put in the gross income. They used to have to. I mean, this is like, within the last 10 years, it has gotten awfully, I don't want to say sloppy, but it's gotten a lot more variable what can be put into these disclosure financials. And a lot of companies don't waste any time And so I have to put in gross income, which is nothing but your sales minus your wholesale cost of the sales. And then I can put that, scoot that, copy it over. Now, part of what I'm doing is, some of you already know these tricks, but I'm just showing them to you because my experience is, if I do this with the MBAs who are 40 years old, they're going to say, how did you do that? Can you do that 5 or 6 more times? Usually with people like you, it's I show you once and you've got, oh, that's cool, I can do that now. So some of this you already know, some of it you might not know, but it just shows you some of the stupid pet tricks. Okay, so now I've got that. I'm looking down through here if there's anything else that I'm going to need to put in. Now, here's one that's interesting. We need this later next week. Depreciation and amortization is actually not usually in the income statement. It's usually hidden up here, and then we have to go over to the statement of cash flows to find it. But Target puts that in there, oddly enough. Okay, I did that. Now I'm happy. Gross margin. That's going to be equal to your gross income divided by your net income, or your revenues. What that number tells us, that every dollar that came into the cash drawer at Target, about 29 cents survived the wholesale cost of it, of what was sold. Put another way, every dollar of sales was at the expense of about 71 cents of wholesale cost for what they sold. Now, it seems like, wow, that's a lot. It varies. What I'd have to do is look at what the industry average is, competitors of Target, what their gross margin is. But that's actually not bad at all. This number is much bigger, like 8.8, 8.9. For service companies, because they don't have wholesale, they do a service. But, I mean, we'll see as we go along. Now, operating margin equals the operating income, otherwise known as EBIT, divided by the sales. This number tells us how much of every dollar that came in to the cash drawer survived the wholesale costs, salaries, wages, light bills, delivery, shipping, everything. And that was about almost 7 cents. Kind of scary. After all of that, you get, after you've paid all of your operating expenses, every dollar turned into only 7 cents. That's not that unusual. Hell itself. Okay, net margin. This is the kind of the big one. This one is your profit, net earnings, divided by your sales. 4.7 cents. What this tells us is that of every dollar that went into the cash drawer, about 6.7 cents belongs to the shareholders. You see, because they get what's left after the bills are paid. We say that the shareholders have the residual claim on cash flows. The prior claim belongs to the debt holders. If you don't pay the debt, you have to pay your debt holders first, and whatever's left belongs to the shareholders. They can get dividends. The company can plow it back into the operations of the company to grow the company and make the stock price go up, we hope. But yeah, for a company like Target, the shareholders got only 4.7 cents of every dollar. Now, this is all over the place. That doesn't sound like a lot. In some businesses, that number is stupid, like 0.5, 0.6. In others, massive, heavy, giant companies like oil companies, that number is a penny. And you say, well, how do they do it? Because they have all those massive fixed costs of vast, insanely huge asset bases all over the world. But a penny on every dollar is actually awesome because they have hundreds of billions of dollars in revenue. So those shareholders do just fine with only a penny of every dollar making it to them and their wallets. Now, ROA. This is equal to the net income, net earnings here, divided by the total assets. This is like saying the entire company is a portfolio. What did that portfolio earn? In this case, it earned 8.5%. That's what it says. Now, is that good or bad? Well, you'd have to look at the industry. And another thing that I'll talk about next week is ROA going up. Sounds great. If it just keeps going up and up and up, that could mean that there is a disaster on the horizon, as happened with the oil refineries. When their ROA just kept going up and up and up, and it was because their total assets kept going down and down and down because they weren't replacing old equipment and they were depreciating out their fixed assets without replacing them. And finally, after 40, 30 years, those refineries started exploding, killing people. Whole communities were wiped out. Workers by the hundreds were killed in the explosions. I was in the oil and gas business at the time this started. I mean, it was phenomenal. They had oil refineries that had not been replaced or even fixed or upgraded since the 1970s, for God's sake. I went through a coal-burning power plant. I may have already told you this story. A coal-burning power plant where the engineer who was showing me everything took me down into the bottom where all of these massive pipes and valves, and it was hot and steamy and noisy and stinky. And I was looking around, and he shone this light on this big, huge pipe. And he said, "What do you see?" And I was looking at it. I didn't quite see it at first, this label. And then it hit me. The label, the stamp on this giant pipe, this big iron pipe, was a swastika symbol. We had bought it back when we were still trading with the Nazis in the 1930s. They did great stuff. We bought that from them, and there it was still in that coal-burning power plant, all those a half century later, for God's sake. Yeah, they don't replace. And then you don't replace, well, sure, your ROA goes through the roof because your total assets are going down because they're depreciating away while your net income is going up. Everyone, yay, ROA is going up every year. Isn't this awesome? Until boom. And then you've got all kinds of mess. And literally some of the cracking towers at the refineries, they just literally fell over, these massive towers where they crack the hydrocarbon products down into distillates and gasoline. So yeah, sometimes a number going up is a good thing, but if it keeps going up, you start asking, why does this keep going up? Are they letting assets, they're just using assets until they cook? Okay, ROE does the same thing, except that we're asking only about how much we're going to take, again, net income, but now we're going to divide it by the total shareholders' equity. Now, this total shareholders' equity on the accounting statement, this is actually how much money investors bought in stock, what it was, the actual amount, plus what survived in net income that wasn't taken away by dividends over all the years the company has lived. So in a way, this is how much that owner's equity, real money, earned as far as net income goes. Now, that'll be bigger than ROA because shareholders' equity is only part of total assets. This is actually a pretty nice number, 30% return to the owning investors, the shareholders. Decent. Now, current assets, the current ratio. This tells us how many times over your current assets, if they were liquidated right away, they could pay the current liabilities. In Target's case, they could pay them 1.0 times over. If they had to liquidate all of their current assets today to pay all of their bills due within a year, they could do it 1.03 times over. That's what it means. Now, there's an old saying, and I hope they still don't teach it, current assets should approximately equal current liabilities, so this number should be about 1. That's actually not true. It has to do with the cash management policy of the company. As a matter of fact, more and more companies are beginning to realize that cash management is so much more important than profit, so much more. We had a course in cash management here years ago. I can't remember what it was, but they're talking about bringing it back, and the chairman asked me if I would teach it in the spring of 2023. Yeah, companies want this, so we're bringing back what had fallen out of favor a long time ago. Now, the quick ratio says this. Look, I'm going to open parentheses, and I'm going to take those current assets. And I'm going to subtract out the inventory. Because realistically, that inventory isn't worth anything like what is on the book. You buy it, and then who's going to buy it from you if you needed to liquidate it? Well, I'll tell you who. It's called factor companies. They'll buy your inventory at pennies on the dollar. I've known some companies, they were desperate. They had to have money to pay a bill. And so they said, they called one of these companies and said, we've got $10 million in inventory. What will you give us for it? And the one company said, $10 million? What are you doing? And they worked it out over a period of about an hour, and they got back and they said, we'll pay you $500,000 for it. We'll have a cash check in your bank account tomorrow morning. What? Yep. You know where you see the result of that? Go to Big Lots. That's where that stuff comes from, is buying the inventory of desperate retailers. That's where it comes from. So we have to close that, and then we say, okay, divide that by your total current assets. That's a more realistic picture of how much of your current liabilities can be covered. Half of them could. And then the burn ratio. The reality is that if you needed money right now to pay all of your current liabilities, the only thing that would matter is your cash. Really. That was what I was telling you about before. Cash divided by current liability. Total current liability. There it is. Wow. 0.42. Now you see why that analyst was dead on. I was so impressed by her, I'm actually following her analyses now. Do you see that? When you got GameStop with that much cash, they're not going out of business. They got enough cash they can buy out anyone who said you owe something. That was, yeah. So, yeah, this was old school. It's kind of coming back, but it's still not in the textbooks. Probably won't be for another 5 years. If then. Okay, so now, debt to total assets. Now, when you do this one, what you should use is your long-term debt and other borrowings. Use this number right here. Now, some say you should also put in the current portion up here, but it's usually a pretty minimal amount. Just put in this number and divide that by your total assets. In other words, target total capital structure is 22.5% debt and therefore 77.5% equity. Capital structure is a combination of debt and equity that makes up a company. Capital structure is a combination of debt and equity that makes up a company. Now understand this. The more debt a company uses in its capital structure, the riskier the company gets because it might not be able to pay its bill, its debt. However, The more debt a company uses, the more it realizes gains to leverage for its shareholders. Now, let me tell you, and I may have already said this, forgive me, sometimes I forget what I say sometimes, but at some point in the next couple of weeks, I'm going to teach you how to become millionaires. And I'm not even joking. This is how a lot of these younger, rich people and couples, they're sitting pretty on this massive amount of money because they used gains to leverage, mostly in real estate. And I will show you how it works. And you can become rich too, beyond your wildest dreams. Or if things go sour, you will be so poor that you'll be pushing a shopping cart down Michigan Avenue in Chicago, sliding along on the ice from the winter winds off the lake. You know, it's a bet, one way or the other. But if you do get rich, you need to remember me, okay? Seriously. Seriously. You know what? What really makes me want to throw my Tonka truck against the wall, I've got some of my students are now making in the million-dollar figures 5 years out. God, that pisses me off. No, you're great. I mean, anyway, let me move on before I get upset about that. Now, time's interest earned. This is how your operating income is how much money you have right before you pay your interest expenses. Now, remember, you have to pay those. So in this case, what we do is we take operating income divided by the interest expense. So Target can pay, with the money that it has to pay interest, it can pay it 6.7 times over. Now, is that good or bad? One thing is for sure. And this is something that I will ask you on a quiz, a midterm, and or a final. You do not ever want to see that number below 1 because that means that you are in default. It's over. If I look at you and I measure your heartbeat and it says 0, well, that's time to check your pockets to see if you have any money and to see if you got any great shoes at your apartment. You see, there are numbers that are absolutely, you do not want to see this. In fact, you start to get worried when this number gets close to 1. You want to have distance. Now, if you have it too high, that tells us that you could afford to take more debt in and get some gains to leverage. But when you see that thing drifting toward 1, I'll give you an actual example, and then I'll finish this up very quickly. Steak and Shake, it was below 1. And there was a lot of speculation that it was going to have to declare bankruptcy and get protection from a bankruptcy court because it had an interest payment due and it didn't have all the money to do it. Somehow they managed to find the money from some angel and they got through it, but still the company is way scary. Now, inventory turnover, you take your sales. Oops. And you divide it by your inventory. This is how many times during the year you cleared your warehouse. Ideally, the higher the better. Until, remember what I said about bottlenecks. Now, the other one is how many times did your sales rotate the entire assets of the company? And in Target's case, it should be around 2, I think. Yeah, 1.8. Now, the last thing you're going to do here, I'm going to format these. These are all percentages. Oops. 2 is good for me. Now, the book wants 6 sometimes. Your company might say 4, 3. For this, the house rule here. These usually 4 decimal places. A number with 4, that's good enough. I mean, that's probably overdoing it. You get into this thing where you get spurious accuracy. Debt to total assets is, actually, that's a percentage. Now, the time's interesting, and I'm going to show you a trick here, but I won't do it here. Whoops, that's a percentage. Yeah. And the asset inventory, see these three numbers? Well, actually, all of these are actually timeses. Now, here's a trick. If you want to put a little time symbol on there, you actually can. Did you see that? You can put units of measure on a calculation. I can put pounds, kilograms, miles, whatever. The trick, obviously, I'll have to format that to a same number. You put an ampersand and then quotation marks and a space and whatever your units of measure you want are. Let me ask, how many of you knew that you could do that? That you can put units of measure? It's actually kind of a cool thing because it makes your sheets look much more professional if you have the units on there. Okay, so now I'm going to put this up on VeggieNet tonight, and then you'll be able to use that at your leisure. That's all I have for you. I thank you.